Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we feature a discussion by your host, Pope Runyon, that's myself, on the controversial subject of Nazi occultism, its origins and its predecessors, and its present-day revival in the cult of the Black Sun. We will explore the early influence from the theosophy of H.P. Blavatsky, the development of the Ariosaphi movement in Germany between the World Wars, the Thule Society of Subotendorf, Himmler and his Runemeister Weisslor, the fascination with Central Asia and the polar myth, and we'll debunk the Spear of Destiny and other Nazi spook books that were more fiction than fact. We will also de-establish the connection an opportunistic European-American magician has been trying to make between the Golden Dawn and Nazism. Now, this is a hot topic and an alarming subject. No matter what your views on it may be, if you are involved in occultism, you need to know about it. So, tune in and we'll spend an hour on the dark side. Now, to get us off on the light side, which is going to be a good idea because we're going to get into some pretty heavy stuff here. But, so, to get us off on the light side, in the 1999 second issue of the Revived Seventh Ray, it came out in 1999, The Red Ray, we ran a special advanced book review. We have some artwork, of course, that goes along with that that we posted on the Blog Talk Radio website, which you might get a kick out of. And the book is called Nazi Bimbos and the Sword of Siegfried by Ernst von Kiesterproben. 269 pages hardcover from Rubber Lederhosen Press. And it was reviewed by Marius Dork. Now, the review is fairly short and light, and I'm going to read you the review here so we can get off on a humorous note here, because the rest of the show is not going to be very humorous. All right. The latest, most authentic, and carefully researched book on the worldwide threat of neo-Nazi occultism in the new millennium is the title forthcoming from Rubber Lederhosen Press, Nazi Bimbos and the Sword of Siegfried by Ernst von Kiesterproben. It's based on the secret archives recently discovered in the Patagonian Odessa files confiscated by the Mossad. Now, this book reveals that in 1945, Hitler's brain was smuggled out of Germany in a Battle of Chartreuse and held by the Nazi werewolf legion at their secret base in Antarctica to be reactivated at the summer solstice performance of Wagner's Gotterdammerung on the edge of the Grand Canyon in June of the year 2000. Now, this apocalyptic event would coincide with a series of underground nuclear explosions and trigger a massive earthquake along the continental divide to split off the new Fourth Reich. Hitler's brain, carefully concealed in the orchestra pit, would be activated by a concentrated ray of sunlight reflected down from the blade, the actual sword of Siegfried, which was originally the sword of the biblical Tubal-Cain, whose genealogy was researched by Van Herby and determined to have been Aryan. And this unholy relic was also smuggled out of Germany, wrapped in the Nazi blood flag by Odessa founder Otto Skorzeny. The concentrated sun rays necessary to jumpstart the Fuhrer's thinker will be reflected from an orbiting satellite mirror, a documented Nazi secret weapon. The construction of this fiendish device will be carried out by disgruntled, unemployed Russian rocket scientists, financed and paid by Odessa, through numbered Swiss bank accounts, and these Russian engineers have already been seduced and brainwashed by the voluptuous twin granddaughters of Nazi war criminal Klaus Barbie. The modern Valkyries will also perform a double Gnostic tantric super whammy sex magic operation, the 16th degree, which is 2/8 degrees rubbing together, climaxing at the moment of solar brain activation, thus impregnating the astral with the dark seed of the newborn Fourth Reich. And although the above synopsis may seem incredible, the author marshals formidable array of evidence to back up his thesis. A fascinating example of this inside information is this quote from the private files of his grandfather, the distinguished Dr. Ludwig von Kiesterproben, who was Hitler's personal proctologist, providing a penetrating assessment of Hitler's occult beliefs. "Der Führer was what we call a mystic Christian. He believed that Christ was a blue-eyed Aryan prophet of the original Hyksos war god Sutekh, who had been identified with the Egyptian demon god Set, whom Hitler in turn equated with the Nordic Fenris wolf. And this demonic cult was ruled Israel until the Ark of the Covenant was stolen after Solomon's reign, and the Ark was not taken to Ethiopia, as many believe, but smuggled eastward to Trans-Mongolian subterranean kingdom of Agartha. This cavern empire's earthly representative was the Bunpo Lama Dorjeev, or George Gurdjieff, with whom Hitler had secretly confided." Now, von Kiesterproben's historical research is impressive. He reveals that the sword of Siegfried, originally forged by the antediluvian patriarch Tubal-Cain, is one of the four Grail Hallows, and it was also known as Excalibur. The British actually possessed this relic during the early days of World War II, and only for this reason did they survive the Battle of Britain. The sword itself would point like a compass needle in the direction of the enemy. However, because the sword belonged to the House of Windsor, the Duke, who was a Nazi sympathizer, took it with him in exile to the Bahamas, where it somehow ended up on a Nazi submarine on its way back to the Reich right before the end of the war. And as for Hitler's brain, it was well known that it was never recovered. The Russians kept this disturbing fact secret. This is overcoming me. Stalin was very concerned about it. The Germans knew more about genetic engineering in 1945 than we know at present. Von Kiesterproben exposes the rumor that the brain was smuggled out in a bottle of schnapps. He exposed this as Odessa disinformation to cover up the truth. It was actually suspended in green chartreuse, which is an ancient alchemical liquor prepared by Cathar monks using 110 secret herbs. Outdoor Wagner ring performances on the rim of the Grand Canyon are not uncommon, one being planned for the year 2000. And as for the giant orbiting sun mirror, this was revealed as a Nazi secret weapon in 1947 issue of Life magazine. And the idea has recently been revived for serious consideration by the scientific community for peaceful purposes. And now that the Sword of Siegfried conspiracy has been exposed, we must move quickly to bring these new super scientific stormtroopers to justice and return the holy sword to its rightful place, stuck in the notch of the Stone of Skull. Okay. Now, had a lot of fun with that one, but that came out in 1999, and in 1999, this was really just before a series of books came out, finally, documenting the real history of Nazi occultism. Before that time, starting with Morning of the Magicians back in 1965, you know, moving on through to a series of really, really ridiculous books like The Spear of Destiny, which was all fiction, and several other books. But there was one by a woman named Dusty Sklar who said that Dorjeef and Aghwan Dorjeef, the Russian-Mongolian Lama secret agent, you know, back during the Great Game era, that he was the same person as George Gurdjieff, the Caucasian magician. And she said in this book that if you look at photographs of George Gurdjieff and Aghwan Dorjeef, that there's a striking resemblance. Well, you look at photographs of those two, and it looks like there's a striking resemblance between maybe General Custer on the one side and Sitting Bull on the other, and that's about as much resemblance. No, so Dusty Sklar's book was ridiculous, and The Spear of Destiny by Ravenscroft is pure fantasy. So many of these what we call Nazi spook books were just plain ridiculous. And our Nazi bimbos and the Sword of Siegfried was a satire on them. But now we have a series of books, and I'm going to review them right quick, which really give you the inside story of Nazi occultism, the way it really was. They're very well documented. The first one that we'll talk about is by the distinguished scholar Goodrich Clark. That's Nicholas Goodrich Clark, and it's called The Occult Roots of Nazism, Secret Aryan Cults and Their Influence on Nazi Ideology. And then we want to look at the real guru of Himmler behind the SS, and this is called The Secret King, Karl Maria Williot, Himmler's Lord of the Runes. And this is by Flowers, I think. Stephen Flowers. And it's edited by Michael Moynihan, and Michael Moynihan, we'll talk about him later a little bit. This book, The Secret King, will give you an idea of what the inner circle Nazi occultism and the SS really was all about. And not all about, because there's one more that I want to mention here that is, I think, essential to understanding the deeper aspects of this. And this is a book called Arctos, Arktos, The Polar Myth in Science, Symbolism, and Nazi Survival, by none other than Jocelyn Godwin, who is a very, very highly respected scholar. And this book, by the way, is published by our friend Hesher Childress, and that probably indicates that Jocelyn Godwin, with all the prestige he has, probably couldn't find a mainstream publisher that wanted to handle it, because it's a real dynamite book. And now, with those books mentioned, and this, as I say, there's one more now covered up that will complete the cycle. What it does is it documents Nazism since World War II and how it has risen again, and traces the history of it, and brings it all the way up to pretty close to the present time. And this is called The Black Sun, and it's also by Nicholas Goodrich Clark, and very, very well documented. And so, if you got these books, you're going to have a pretty good handle on this situation. Now, let's go back and start at the beginning, and see if we can put this together and look at it, because it was something that almost destroyed the world, and it came very close, as we are only now beginning to learn how close
the Nazis really came to winning World War II. They came very, very close. And they some of the these weapons that we thought were fanciful actually turned out to be very, very, very close to coming into actual practice and actual use. And they had they almost had the atomic bomb, and they were very, very close, and they had the delivery net, they had the airplanes to bomb New York and Chicago. We were so fortunate. In fact, it's probably true that the uranium, the processed yellow cake that we used to bomb Japan, we very probably got from Nazi Germany, you know, because they'd already been defeated, and we confiscated their uranium. So, and we didn't have very much, and so it's very possible that the extra yellow cake we needed came from Nazi Germany. How close we came? Oof, it's frightening. Now, so this is something that we need to understand. And we need to understand it, and that doesn't mean we have to like it, it doesn't mean we have to agree with it, and it doesn't even mean we have to be sympathetic, but we have to understand it. And there's been so much propaganda, so much emotionally based propaganda, and so much smokescreen blown over this, because some of the subjects are embarrassing, some of the background's embarrassing, and therefore there's an old adage that those who do not study histories, the mistakes in history are bound and doomed to repeat them. So we need to look at this. We need to see how it came about. Now, Germany, back in the Renaissance period, Germany was fragmented into a whole bunch of little kingdoms, and it really was a kind of a nation, but it was fragmented into all these little kingdoms, and they were little segments and duchies and principalities left over from the medieval Holy Roman Empire. So German nationalism, getting the German people together and giving them a feeling of nationalism, didn't really come about until the early part of the late part of the 1700s and the early part of the 1800s. The idea of getting the German people together in one nation hadn't quite gelled yet. But once it did, once this wave of nationalism swept over Europe, then the Germans became fiercely desirous of becoming a nation. They had a strong feeling of identity, and so the first, Frederick the Great, of course, but then Otto Bismarck in the 1800s, and he finally put Germany together and made it into a nation. And once it became a nation, it developed very quickly. It developed a strong sense of nationalism. Now, nationalism itself, it was kind of a new phenomenon. It was a phenomenon that was coming into vogue as part of the so-called Enlightenment period in the 1700s, 1600s, 1700s, what they called the Enlightenment, where they began to think about getting rid of the old vestiges of the old feudal system, and you had the Masonic movement was getting started. We were thinking more about returning to the old ancient ideas of a republic, and breaking the power of the church, which was really, really rather over. The church had way too much power, and how people thought and what they believed and whatever. As science was progressing and what have you. So, and also we began at the beginnings of the industrial age, this whole idea of a political of a new representative political government in a national sense. This became a spirit all over Europe, this idea of nationalism. Now, the Germans were very industrious. Now, one thing I want to make clear right at the beginning here. We make a big mistake in studying Nazism and analyzing Nazism. You make a big mistake if you blame it on some sort of flaw in the German character. That's something that some people tend to do. And don't do that. Don't fall into that. Because if you fall into that, then you're going to have to fall into the idea of saying that the IRA is a result of a flaw in the Irish character. And you will fall into the idea that Custer's last stand was a result of a big flaw in the Sioux Indian character. And any time that you start looking at people who rebel against any kind of oppression, and you say that they're rebelling because they have a flaw in their character, watch it. That's not good anthropology. So that's what you don't want to fall into. And what happened with the Germans and was they were very, very industrious people, had a very strong work ethic, and whether that's cultural or hereditary or anything, I ain't going to say one way or the other, who knows. But whatever it was, the German people were very industrious and very, very had a strong work ethic, and they had a strong sense of identity. And they wanted to have, they weren't that much of a maritime nation. They were in there contained in Europe, and they hadn't had, because they'd been so fragmented, they really didn't have a chance to develop a navy like the British did. And so they wanted to have a colonial empire. Now, during the nationalist period, everybody, including even the United States, were going out and grabbing colonies. We were going out and we were grabbing every underdeveloped country we could find and making it a colony and exploiting them. And of course, this was going on. And Germany wanted an empire too. And they said, "All right, we're a nation now, and we're very industrious, and our manufacturing and our engineering is better than the British," and it was too. And we have better products, and we have better customer service, and we're going to have an empire, and we're going to go out there, we're going to have a navy, and we're going to do all these things. And so they did. They wanted to. Well, of course, the British they had developed quite an empire and colonies and all over the world, and they didn't like that very much, even though the British are. Yeah, they're very close to the Germans in heritage as far as where they, their ethnic heritage and all that. But they still, the Germans were a real competition for them. And the same thing with the French. The French had, to a lesser extent, they had developed a colonial empire. So during this period of nationalism what is generally referred to as the Victorian Age, there was this race for colonies, everybody. And all of the European nations dreamed about this, and the Germans were going to do it. So they got colonies in Africa, and they got colonies out in the South Pacific, and they got colonies, the little colonies, all over the place. They tried to, tried to compete with the British, and they did for a while. Well, this began to, this, European nationalism and the thirst for empire, the expansion. What's happening here is literally it's a form of expansion. Europeans, and this included, by the way, this included the Russian Europeans, and the Russians, west of the Urals, the Russians are pretty much European. And the Russians developed this huge empire, and they were in the whole empire race too, and so building up toward World War I,
we had this these empires rubbing against each other. Now, interestingly enough, Germany and Russia were absolute monarchies. The Romanov dynasty in Russia, they ruled absolute. That was divine right, and they hadn't gone through the democratic process or the democratizing process that Britain had, and of course the French had had that revolution, and they had all kinds of convolutions. But the British had become by this time pretty much of what we call a constitutional monarchy. And they weren't quite that way when we had the revolution. When we broke away from them, they were still not quite as what would you call a constitutional monarch at that time. They pretended to be, but they weren't quite. The king had too much power then. But by the time World War I was building up, the British were constitutional monarchy. Now, the Russians, however, were not absolute monarchy. Austria-Hungary, that empire, absolute monarchy. The Germans were absolute. The Kaiser, absolute monarchy. So you had an old-fashioned, very egotistical, very fanatical kind of government. And here these empires are all in conflict, and in they're making these treaties, and they're fighting with each other. They're trying to spread their colonies all over the place. Now, this is happening, but an anthropologist in Germany, I call him an anthropologist because probably at that time in anthropology I called it ethnology. A man by the name of Oswald Spengler wrote a landmark book, and this is one you need to write down, The Decline of the West. And Spengler foresaw that this whole business of the race for colonies and this exploitation of the Third World and all of this, this jockeying for power and everything, that this was going to be the high watermark of European and, by proxy, American civilization. That this would be the high watermark. That we could not continue to do this. That we would go into decline, and that eventually Europe, to include America as an extension of Europe, would go into decline. And if you want to be racist about it, you could say that the white race will go into decline after this. In other words, now we're dominating the world. We had suppressed China and even made the Japanese and were a kind of a they were an odd card in this whole procedure. They were almost acting like Europeans, but still, what you might call the white race, we were dominating the world. And Spengler foresaw that this would be the peak, that we'd extended ourselves as far as we could, and that now we would go into decline. So he wrote this monumental treatise called The Decline of the West. Now, this book is the linchpin. This book was tremendously influential on Hitler. Hitler must have read it, I don't know, he probably read it about four or five times. He studied it. Now, Spengler was not a racist. Spengler described, he was more of an anthropologist, he described these nations and their rise and fall as cultures. And yeah, racism didn't, but Hitler, reading that in Spengler, to make Spengler work for Germany in Hitler's equation, all he had to do was take Spengler and translate Spengler's culture into the German race, and he could use all of Spengler's theories, which he did. Now, Spengler's book, The Decline of the West, by the way, is now available in a nice abridged edition. You don't have to read, I think it came out with four or five volumes, a big thing, huge. You don't have to read the whole thing anymore. It's a very nice abridged edition. You can get a grasp on it. Very well worth reading. And by the way, Spengler's Decline of the West, I don't think George Bush ever, W. I ever read it, but certainly his neocons did.
I mean, that, you know, Rove and that bunch, the neocons that tried to create an American empire, they read Decline of the West. So this is one that the Nazis certainly they made a lot of use out of. Now, what happened? Of course, World War One started by accident, and it's been said that they didn't want it, but actually they did. I mean, none of these people thought that it would end up to be the horror that it ended up being. None of them did. They all thought, oh, well, we're going to have this thing, it'll be over in about less than a year, and we'll win, and we'll come out ahead, and everybody will get a medal, and yeah, it'll be where. No, this turned into, one of the most horrible events in human history. And for just downright misery, World War One was worse than World War Two for just plain downright human misery. And after World War One, now you need to understand, and this needs to be understood very clearly. Germany did not lose World War One on the battlefield. That needs to be understood. They didn't. There was not a single Allied boot on German soil. In fact, the German army occupied sections of Allied territory at the time of the armistice. Why did the Germans accept this armistice that was virtually an unconditional surrender? Why did they accept it? Well, the German people didn't understand why they did. The German army didn't understand why they did. And the reason why they did was because they didn't have any money. They were broke. And they couldn't feed their troops. They couldn't feed their people. They were broke. Completely. Wiped out. Why? Because the banks, the international banks, pulled their money out of Germany. Now, I am not, because this is a, you know, like I say, this is a family show, and there are certain things we can't say. No, we don't want to go too deeply into this, but let's just say that the German people, whether it's true or not, or whatever, regardless, and I don't want to have an opinion one way or the other, but the German people were told that this was all a Jewish conspiracy and that the Jews had pulled their money out of the banks and caused Germany to collapse. And that's so Germany had to sign an armistice that was virtually an unconditional surrender. And they were convinced, the German people were convinced that this was true. Now, what happened in Germany, while the rest of the world very quickly recovered, and we had a boom in the United States, and they had a boom in some areas in Europe. Oh God, the Roaring Twenties, and everybody was buying land and drinking champagne out of slippers, and the flappers were dancing on the tabletops, and we were all just having a wonderful time, and living high on the hog. In Germany, as you've heard, it took a wheelbarrow load of German marks to buy a loaf of bread. People were starving. People were desperate. And they were, and the army, the German army, were all home without jobs and were thought they'd been betrayed, including a young, hard-charging young corporal who, well, thought he was going blind as a result of a gas attack, lying there and hearing all this in the hospital. And when he recovered, he bowed and determined he was going to do something about it. And at this time, the Russians had their revolution, and they carried it across. And of course, the perverted thing about this was that the Kaiser had fomented and paid for the Russian communist revolution, shipped Lenin in there in a closed train and all of that. But then the Russians, the Cheka, the Russian secret police and all that, they sent operatives into Germany. And they started a Bolshevik revolution in Germany. Now, this is something a lot of people don't know about, but they took over Munich at one point. At one point, they ran the red flag up in Munich, and they had they were in charge, the Russian. And these were not just German communists, well, they were German, but they were led by Russian. They were led by Bolsheviks. They had a red flag, hammer and sickle. They were and this terrified the average German person, the average German people. They were just disgusted and horrified by this. And here, all in, it wasn't just Munich, it was all over Germany. They just about came within a scant inch of taking over Germany and turning all of Germany into a communist state. Well, the German people, miserable as they were, they wouldn't put up with it. And so they, and of course, here again, they blamed the Jews for this. And unfortunately, a sizable percentage of the German Russian Bolshevik leaders were Jewish, and so here again this anti-Semitism thing comes up. Now, at this point, you have a situation here where you have a highly civilized, highly industrialized, very very modern country in a state of absolute chaos. And I mean, it just, and people are starving, the police can't do anything, there are mobs in the streets, there are everything. It's about as bad as you can imagine. Now, at this point, an organization led by a very mysterious and very, very skillful occultist, and military man too, as so many occultists turn out to be, Rudolf Sobotendorf, who learned some of his skills and some of his occultism among the Turks. He took over an organization and turned an occult lodge into a paramilitary organization. This was the Thule Society, spelled T-H-U-L-E, but it's pronounced Thule. The Thule Society in Munich. Now, he drew on these fringe groups of German occultists who had their own version of Blavatsky's theosophy, and they recooked Blavatsky's theosophy, which was somewhat anti-Christian and based on Indian Vedic theology, as we have discussed the previous week. And so earlier on, 30, 40, 50 years back, these German, starting with this old fellow Guido von Liszt, who had a beard down to his waist and all that, was kind of a very much of a mystical prophet. He started creating a German form of occultism using runes and using Nordic mythology and whatever. And, people were interested, but, I mean, it was not anything that was tremendous. And as Hitler said, Guido von Liszt had no political influence at all. But it was an interesting form of Wagnerian, Nordic sort of occultism. And then he was followed by a fellow by the name of Lanz Liebenfels, who made it more practical, turned it into a lodge, hooked it up with the Parseval and the Grail legend and whatever, and created the new Templars. This was using Guido von Liszt's version of theosophy, which had been Nordicized. And they called this, by the way, Ariosophy. This was the term for it. It wasn't exactly theosophy. It had been, Blavatsky was, she was pushing the Aryan idea, but basically from a Hindu model. But it fitted into making this mystical Aryan race. and attributing a great deal more occult knowledge and wisdom to the barbaric Germans than they probably ever had. But it appealed to German nationalism, and it appealed to, it's a kind of like Wagner, you know. I mean, Hitler loved Wagner. He used to go to Wagnerian operas, and he'd starve himself when he was an art student just to go to Wagner and listen to Wagner all afternoon. And in fact, he had a crush on Wagner's granddaughter, too, before he met Eva Braun. I'm not trying to make Hitler sound like a nice guy. No, you know, this is not springtime for Hitler. You know, I mean, it's just, if you see the producers, you know, springtime for Hitler. And all the chorus line out there singing, you know, don't be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party. And, oh, boy. I'm not trying to romance Hitler. But still, this what Sibokendorf did, he when the communists were really the threat, then the Germans needed something to give them power. They needed a symbol. They needed something to rally to fight off the communists. And Sibokendorf was an occultist. He was a damn good astrologer, and he was a good occultist. So he grabbed Lance Liebefeld's and Guido von Liszt's material, and he plugged that into the Thule Society, and he says, okay, that's good, but we need guns. And so the Thule's headquarters became an arsenal, and they went on the barricade, and they defeated the communists in Munich, and they hauled down the communist red flag in Munich. They hauled it down. They painted the center out and painted the center white in that communist flag, painted out the hammer and sickle, and they put a black swastika in it. And that was the origin of the Nazi flag. And so this was the esoteric beginning. And then Hitler came along. And now, one thing I got to understand, that this whole business of left wing and right wing is really kind of almost a propaganda term. It's like democracy. Nobody knows what democracy means. And did you ever know of any communist government that didn't call itself a democratic people's republic? They all do. So democracy is a propaganda word. And right wing and left wing is a propaganda word. Because Hitler and the Nazis, they started this thing off. It was they didn't like capitalism. They hated it. They thought it'd betray them, and so they were the National Socialist Workers' Party, the Nazis. You call that right wing? Why not the Workers' Party? And now you look at Triumph of the Will, and you see 10,000 stalwart day laborers all holding their shovels up in unison and going, Heil Hitler. Yeah, it was the Nazi, it was the National Workers' Party, Laborers' Party. They were just about communist. Just about, the only thing that wasn't communist about them was is that they shined their boots every morning, whereas, you know, communists only shine their boots once a week if they do that much. But then... As the Nazis began to gain power, and as they began to get more powerful, Hitler, being a very, very cagey, and before he went crazy, but being very smart and a very practical, pragmatic politician, he began to realize that I don't think I want to make enemies out of the Junkers. The German corporation, the big corporations. I don't want to make enemies out of Krupp, and I don't want to make enemies out of you know, Dr. Porsche and Louis Messerschmitt and all of the, you know, and Faber and all the rest of these big German companies. Why don't I get them on my side? So he all of a sudden, from being a so-called left winger, he all of a sudden becomes a right winger. But still, it it's the National Socialist Workers Party. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, so how much, you have to ask yourself, just what is right wing, what is left wing? Doesn't matter too much. In fact, so what happens is that you, it's whoever sits there in power and what the actual power structure is, that's what determines. Now, so the Nazis defined their revolution and their idea by unifying the German people, giving the German people a sense of identity, and being very, very strong on this mystical idea of the race and the pure blood and all of that. Now, Hitler said about the Jews, even though Hitler had his own, you know, when he was lying there blind in the hospital and hearing all this business about how the Jews had pulled the money out of Germany and caused Germany to collapse and all that. He hated the Jews, that's true. But he also had sense enough to know that he was using them as a scapegoat. In fact, he said one time, he said, "Thank God for the Jews. If they hadn't have existed, we would have had to invent them." Yeah, they needed a scapegoat. And so it became the Jews. Now this actually, had he at a certain point backed out of this, he would have done a lot better and he might have won World War II if he'd backed out of it. But he unfortunately, there one of Hitler's problems was he was stubborn as a mule and he wouldn't give up any idea he had. He'd just carry it through regardless. And so he carried this thing through, and it ended up, that's one of the factors, one of the reasons why he lost the war. But the point that I'm making here about Nazism is that it is the mystique of the blood, the mystique of the race. And he used this as a unifying factor. And one of the reasons why I personally have some understanding. I have understanding of Nazism, how it arose, how it developed, and all of that. And I could even say, to some degree, I could sympathize maybe with their feelings. But I couldn't possibly be a Nazi because I'm a Mason. I mean, for heaven's sake. And the first thing they wanted to do is close down all the Masonic lodges because they thought the Masons were part of the Jewish conspiracy. And of course, Masons also, we have a belief that all men are entitled, all men and women are entitled to equal treatment under law and equal treatment and respect. And we should respect all religions and we should respect all cultures. And as long as a person is law-abiding and productive and whatever, then we're all for them. So that's essential. And Masonry is, of course, what was behind the American Revolution and what was behind the establishment of the United States. So Americanism, and Hitler knew this, by the way, Americanism is Masonry. And so consequently, we cannot support Nazism. There's just no way. But, however, we can understand how it came about. And that's the important thing about Nazism, is to understand how it came about and understand that things like this can come about again if you don't learn the right lessons. Now, I said that we would, in this case here, before we get toward the end of the hour here, I want to touch a few bases here that we mentioned in the abstract so we actually don't forget anything. One of the things about the Nazi myth, the occult Nazi myth, and we are, of course, this is the Hermetic Hour, so we're concerned with their magic. And one of the things that I want to point out is that there's been a lot of speculation about just what it was that they were looking for sending these expeditions to Tibet and into Central Asia. What were they looking for? Part of that was based on Blavatsky's idea that Tibet was the secret home of the Aryan race. Blavatsky had this, and she thought, and she gave the idea. Actually, it was a ruse, as we know. But the idea arose that somewhere in Tibet there was this underground kingdom of Shambhala, or maybe it was in Mongolia, and there was some rumors to that. And other people said it was called Agartha, but there was this underground kingdom where the secret masters who were Aryan. And so this idea had not yet been debunked, and we hadn't discovered yet, nobody discovered yet that Blavatsky had actually transplanted a Hindu master and a Sikh Sadh master and moved him into Tibet just to protect him from the British. And we hadn't discovered that yet, so still, and Himmler, in his mystical sense, and Himmler really was an occultist. Himmler wasn't that much of an occultist, but Himmler really was. And Himmler sent his these expeditions to Tibet looking for these Aryan masters, these secret masters. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, and Joshua Godwin's Arctos is one you really need to read in this respect, because there really was, not so much in Tibet, but in Mongolia, up around the Altai region in there, this religion of the not the Mongols now, let's don't get it confused, the early Scythians, who were quite probably an Aryan group, and the Turks, who, although they weren't exactly what you might call Aryan, but they were certainly not Mongols, they, in that area, they were the ones, their shamanism was one of the oldest religions, as far as we were able to tell, in the world. And they worshipped the North Star and the wheel of the North. And this is the very, very ancient idea that souls go up the Milky Way up to the North Pole. Now, a book that you should read along with this to understand all of this is Hamlet's Mill by de Saint-Anne and Van Dekken. Now, the mystic, the really mystic secret behind the swastika is not that it's a solar symbol, but that it is, if you put it on the North Star, you put it on the tail of the bear, you see that those arms of the swastika, especially in the Nazi configuration, those arms of the swastika point to the solstices and the equinoxes. All right? And those stars in the Big Dipper, those seven stars are the seven ancient masters. This is the very ancient polar myth. Now, we also are fairly certain that representatives of this ancient religion came down into ancient Greece around 500 BC and had an influence on Pythagoras, Empedocles, Parmenides. In other words, this very, very, very ancient religion may have seeded what eventually became the Hermetic tradition. So, you know, this is very deep stuff. And I can't get that deeply into it, but I very much suggest that you read The Polar Myth by Jocelyn Godwin. This is what the Nazis were looking for. Now, as it turns out, more recently, we've learned a lot more about this. And you understand now that the back of Blavatsky and Pike and Manly Hall and many, many people back in the before believed that there was a very, very ancient religion that was superior and that just devolved from it. That this was the Ur-cultus. And this was what they were looking for. Now, we've dug up recently, I say we, Chinese archaeologists have, and they've allowed some European archaeologists to take a look at it. And we saw these mummies, by the way, at the Bowers Museum. Caucasian mummies from 4,000 years ago in the deserts of Mongolia, and they are Caucasian. I looked down at one of these beautiful ladies, and she's still beautiful. She could be a movie actress. I mean, really. And it's amazing. So, old Blavatsky and Rorick and all of that bunch, they were onto something. Now, the other thing, though, however, is that Himmler, in his whimsical way, was looking for the King of Fear, who Agwan Dorjeev, and they wanted to contact Agwan Dorjeev, of course. And unfortunately, by this time, Agwan Dorjeev had managed to get the Tsar to build him a Kala Chakra temple in St. Petersburg, and then he managed to talk Lenin into letting him keep the temple, and then he was playing both sides against the middle, and he was doing okay, but then he ran up against Stalin. And Stalin, you know, looked at Dorjeev and said, "There is not room in this country for the two of us. Off to the gulag with you." So poor old Agwan Dorjeev, while Himmler was looking for him, thinking he was still very, very influential and big Central Asian guru and knew all the mysteries and all that. But unfortunately, the old man was digging turnips in the gulag, and so it was a fruitless quest. But Himmler, now let me just mention that Himmler's guru, Carl Maria Willigut, certified nut, and yet, you know, very, very talented mystic, and like he was about as crazy as Richard Schaefer. He believed that there was a 200,000-year-old German civilization that had their own Christ. Everybody has to have a Christ, you know. Willigut was the personal counselor, occult counselor for Himmler. And he was the master of the runes. Now, you can read all about that this book that by Stephen Flowers is edited by Michael Moynihan. Michael Moynihan, by the way, is, Michael Moynihan likes, I think he likes the Nazis a lot more than I do. Let's put it that way. Black Sun, we're going to deal with this. What's happened after, Jean-Marie, what do we got time-wise? Are we going to give me a little more time? Give me 3 minutes? Okay. The Black Sun, the revival of Nazism started in this country with George Lincoln Rockwell. And George Lincoln Rockwell was a very smart man and really believed what he was doing, but he presented Nazism sort of as a farce, because he thought he could get away with it better that way, but that was a ruse. Actually, he did really want to create the Nazi Party, and he pretty much did. And it went through several transitions, but then finally, in the 1980s, when some of the policies in the United States really began to take effect, and some of the very, very liberal policies began to take effect, the Nazi movement really began to take hold. And now, of course, we have a real Nazi problem. By the way, the Golden Dawn has no connection whatsoever with Nazism, never did, never will. Its Kabbalah is Zoharic. And our friend over there in Sweden, and I think you all know who he is, who's going around wearing an iron cross with his Golden Dawn regalia. He's just an opportunist. It has no connection with, and never did have. Okay, next week we're going to do Orgones and Wilhelm Reich. So until then, good magic.